Central Time. I'm Rob Ferry. Now, if you're looking to add some variety to your baking, try using farro flour, maybe einkorn berries, or another heritage grain. Our next guest works with a variety of grains, growing them, milling, and cooking with them. She says using different grains can add great flavor and texture, give options for people with special dietary needs, including gluten-free options, and they can help the environment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone against the grain with your cooking, using stuff apart from the typical all-purpose white and wheat flours? Do you use barley, farro, oats, durum, you name it? Have you found heritage grains accessible maybe in your local stores or markets? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emma Zimmerman is the author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She's officially been experimenting with milling grains since 2011 with her dad. Emma, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about these grains.
What got you and your dad into this wide variety of grains and flours and growing them and milling them in the first place?
Yeah, so we're in Phoenix, Arizona, and there is a heritage grain that's been in this region for a while called White Sonora Wheat. And that was kind of our first foray into this whole world of heritage grains. And we started growing it. We were 10 acres with a local farmer. Loved it. Got some excitement from chefs and local bakers. And that just kind of led to like discovering this whole world of grains that had been forgotten. And we're kind of, you know, just sitting in seed banks, not getting eaten or enjoyed.
So it sounds like fun growing it and milling it and all. But for maybe that home cook who's listening right now, if they asked, what's in it for me? What would you tell them about opening up their eyes to some of this variety?
Well, I could, you know, go on about like health benefits of whole grains and all that stuff. I love like getting people excited about the flavors and kind of like I always compare it to maybe coloring with, you know, the 64 pack of crayons. Like you just have a lot more options and a lot more, you know, that you can do with your creativity in the kitchen, having, flour that's not just sort of like a white inert substance that doesn't quite offer anything. You know, it becomes more of a central player in your kitchen, which is really fun. The book, The Miller's Daughter, has 10 different grains and legumes. And there's just so many different ways that you can prepare these grains as well. So it's even beyond baking. If people aren't considering themselves bakers, there's something for everyone.
Well, let's check out one of the grains now. And I've used this. I don't actually know what it is. I don't even know if I'm saying it right. Farro, F-A-R-R-O. Farro or farro?
Yeah.
Farro.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Either way, actually.
Excellent. Good. And then, like I said, I've cooked with it. I've eaten it. I don't actually know what it is. What is farro?
So farro is a very old grain. We call it an ancient grain because it's thousands of years old. It's sort of a precursor to what we know as modern wheat. Some people call it farro because it is the pharaoh's wheat. It's a very old variety that probably ancient Egyptians were eating. And it's a really nutty, deeply flavorful grain. Yeah, you can cook it whole like rice. So there's a bunch of salads in the book. It makes such a great salad. And you can mill it and turn it into flour. There's a farro banana bread that has some chocolate in it as well. And those are some of my favorite recipes. Farro is pretty accessible as well right now. Most people listening could probably find it either just in their local supermarket or at a local mill near them. But it's pretty well established here. It's really popular in Italian cooking as well.
Now, we've got that recipe. You shared it with us. It's up at WPR.org/Food Friday, the chocolate-flecked farro banana bread. So what is having farro? Now, this is like, it's not the whole farro, as you said. It's like a farro milled flour. What does that do? How does it make the banana bread different?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you have that recipe up. That's kind of my go-to when people ask, like, where do we start, you know, with this book? Because everyone, you know, banana bread, like, pretty accessible. Everyone can make banana bread, I hope.
It's not too hard. Even so, I can do it. Yeah,
it's not too hard. And I mean, I always have overripe bananas on hand. It always seems I'm like a little too ambitious buying bananas every week. But farro flour is a great swap for that white flour. And it's a great way to kind of taste the difference in adding a stone milled ancient grain flour into your baking. People always love that recipe. It's so fun to serve it to friends and family because it tastes familiar, but it just has that extra layer of something else. So it always kind of starts a conversation about these grains.
Talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains, Stories and Recipes from Hayden Flour Mills. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you like to cook or bake with different kinds of grains and flours? What are your favorites? What have you experimented with? Do you have a question for a guest? Maybe you tried it and it didn't come out so good. Maybe Emma could help you out. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Emma, a lot of times we're going to buy flour already milled. What are options for getting something that's in, you know, a harder, chunkier form if we want to get something and grind it up at home? Are there some we can do that with?
Yes, you could get into home milling. It's not something that I've personally explored, seeing as I own a flour mill. I can just go get my flour
very
there.
Fair.
But yeah, there you can home mill anywhere, you know, from like a blender attachment to something like a little more substantial as a countertop mill or a hand mill. But that's really the ultimate. And that's how we got started, honestly, is my dad was baking bread and then he started milling his own flour to kind of, you know, enhance the fresh taste of his flour. And one thing led to the next, and all of a sudden the home countertop mill, you know, got a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger until now we have a whole milling operation.
Mission creep for sure. Yeah. Let's check out some other grains. Now barley, I just think of, you know, barley is barley, and you go and buy a package with the word barley on it. There's different kinds of barley, and you've got, I think, purple barley, for example. Can you tell us about some of the variety in the barley world?
Yeah. So there is bronze barleys. We grow a variety of Tibetan purple barley. It's just really fun. It is purple in the field. Like, so if you were, you know, flying overhead with a drone, you could actually see this lavender colored field. And then the seeds are very deep, rich purple. So just from, you know, from that, like, it's so fun to cook with. There's a recipe in the book that's a barley lemonade. And really pretty, like, violet purple color. And Ooh. It's very delicious and a refreshing. And that's always really fun to surprise people with. But yeah, barley, I think, has kind of that, like, pearly stew reputation. And I tried to steer away from that and make barley a little more exciting. There's a lot of cuisines throughout the world that use barley as well. So a lot of inspiration there. But yeah, purple barley is the one that we grow and really love at the mill, even though there's a lot of different varieties. If your food can be more colorful, why not?
Well, here's the one that got me, because I grew up with my Polish grandma's pierogies. And you've got a purple potato pierogi using ideally this purple barley. Tell us about this one.
Yes. So I hope someone will make this recipe.
But I might.
It's a purple barley, dumpling and, you know, wrapper. And then the purple potato inside. So it's like purple on purple. I love cooking with color in mind. So anytime I can play with color and also make it delicious, I just can't resist. So that one was really fun to do. And yeah, like if you make bread with purple barley flour, that bread will have a lavender color. Like, it's just really fun.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She's talking with us about how we can experiment in the kitchen with more than just that all-purpose, say, white flour by using a lot of different heritage grains, other kinds of flours. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever tried milling your own flour from, say, wheat berries or whatever before, how did it go? Do you use different kinds of flours in your cooking or baking, different kinds kinds of grains. If you are gluten-free for one reason or another, what kind of grains have you had success with where stuff comes out with great flavors and textures? Or do you have questions for our guest about what to do with all this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Remember, we got that banana bread made with Faro recipe. There's some chocolate in there, too. Find it at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. After experimenting with growing and milling grains for more than a decade with her dad, Emma's with us to talk about using a lot of different types of grains and flours in our own cooking and baking. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences using different grains, maybe growing or milling them yourself, or your questions, 800-642-1234. Linda joins us in Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I happen to be Jewish, and, you know, we Jews have the holiday of Passover, and that lasts 8 days, and you were not allowed to eat any leavened products. Nothing with yeast, no leavening. And the reason for that is because when we had to leave Egypt, we had no time to let the bread rise. And so we have to be very ingenious, you know, because matzah is just flour and water. So I make something that's Persian. It's called a spinach mina. And what it is you wet matzah and you put it in an oiled or buttered or greased, whatever, 8-inch pan. I use glass. And then you layer in meat, cooked chopped meat. You can put almonds in it if you want to. And then I make about a 3-inch layer of that. And then you put another piece of wet matzah on top, and you pour a beaten egg over the whole thing and bake it.
Wow.
And it's absolutely delicious.
That sounds fantastic, Linda. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Emma, do you have favorite flours or grains that work well as a bread-like product that is unleavened, that's no yeast in the picture?
Yeah, oh, that recipe sounded so
totally
good. Yes, there's a few cracker recipes in the book, that's with a type of wheat called Durum. It's a pasta wheat. We grow a heritage variety called Bluebeard Durum that has these blue awns on it, kind of creating this blue beard effect in the field. But that's a really delicious pasta wheat, and it also makes really great crackers because it gives that same kind of like firm crunch to it. But yeah, a lot of the recipes in the book, I don't do a lot of bread kind of baking. There's a few things, but not a lot of yeast. So it's not, you know, when people hear about ancient and heritage grains, they think of those sourdough kind of European style loaves. But in this case, I really wanted to showcase all the other ways that you could use these grains. Maybe if sourdough is a little bit intimidating, or using yeast can be a little bit intimidating, but quick breads, crackers, whole grain salads, you know, waffles, pancakes, there's so many things that you can do with these grains. And in fact, it's almost better to keep things really simple. That way you can taste the actual flavor of the grain as you're baking.
Thanks a lot for that call, Linda, at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us next in Appleton. Sharon, hi.
Hi, well, I'm gluten sensitive, not celiac, and I've used gluten-free grains for years. And I never buy gluten-free flours pre-mixed because they're just filled with potato starch and corn starch and no whole grains. So I keep about a dozen different gluten-free flours in my refrigerator almost any time. And I'll just take any recipe. I don't do yeasted things because that's too hard. But quick bread, cookies, pancakes, waffles, etc. If it says a cup of flour, I'll just grab maybe 3 different kinds of gluten-free flours, a third a cup of each, unless I'm using coconut. And then I use a little less because coconut soaks up the moisture just a lot. And then just start to play with how the different textures you get from the different flours.
Sharon, what are a couple of your rock star flours that you go to?
Oh, sorghum. So sorghum and coconut if you want something really moist.
Excellent.
And then if you want something a little bit lighter, and I will go with rice or millet. You know, I sometimes I put in, well, like for pancakes, I love buckwheat, a little buckwheat, but not
okay.
straight.
Sharon, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing all that with us. Emma, one thing that popped to my mind is you've got a whole chapter on chickpea flour in the book.
Yes. Yeah, so chickpea is also one of the gluten-free flours. There's a whole world. I mean, I covered 10 types of flours and grains, but there's, as Sharon mentioned, sorghum and buckwheat and so many other things you wouldn't typically think that you can turn into flour. Chickpeas are great. Because they're naturally gluten-free. They grow really well as a cover crop for wheat, so they're great to rotate in. And yeah, you can make such amazing things from chickpea flour. There's a chickpea flour pound cake in the book that I really love with this tahini glaze and a baharat spice. You can make chickpea fries. Those always go really fast. But yeah, it's a really fun flour to kind of play with and a great option if you're trying to stay away from gluten. I will say that a lot of our customers who come to us because they are gluten sensitive and they find that they can eat these older varieties, these heritage grains, these ancient grains with no reaction. So that's really hopeful too. Another reason that we think these grains are worth growing.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Emma Zimmerman is with us on this week's edition of Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains, Stories and Recipes from Hayden Flour Mills. Emma, let's talk about the grain that you mentioned earlier, started it all, that white Sonora flour. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, white Sonora wheat is the first wheat that came to North America. The legend is that it was brought over by Jesuit German missionaries, you know, bringing the foods from home. Also needed wheat flour to, you know, make the Eucharist. So it's been here in the Southwest for 400 years. So it became acclimated, what we call a land race. One of the reasons we love it is because of that story and because it takes less water to grow, which is a huge thing for us here in Arizona. We need to take a lot of care with our water. So having a crop that's arid adapted is really great. And, you know, so probably something we need to do more of in the future. It tastes great. It's so beautiful. I actually got married 10 years ago, and that was my wedding bouquet because I thought it was just so beautiful. So
awesome. Now, you mentioned some of the environmental benefits there. Can you talk? That's something you talk about a little bit in the book, and we've been focusing on, you know, cooking with the stuff. But what are some more of the environmental benefits of checking out these wider varieties of ancient grains?
Yeah, they are really great, especially in conjunction with regenerative agriculture practices. Are really great for the soil. They demand less inputs, so they can be, you know, a lower cost to a farmer, and yeah, lower water. So yeah, that's all part of the story, you know, beyond just the flavor and kind of the excitement and the creativity that comes from using these grains. We also think they're kind of part of our future, and we need to go back and recover a lot of that biodiversity that we've lost in the industrial food system. And the best way to, you know, promote biodiversity in our food system is to eat these grains and, of course, to have really good recipes that inspire people to use them.
There's been some chatter among Central Time producers about what your farm and operation looks like. Can you kind of paint us a picture of what we would see if we were taking a tour?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, so Hayden Flour Mills is actually a historic mill that started in Tempe, Arizona. But our mill is not located there anymore. We restarted the mill. It had been out of business for a while. So in 2011, my dad and I restarted it. And we actually are now located on the farm, kind of on the outskirts of Phoenix, where we grow a lot of our wheat. So it's very cool that we're kind of this vertically integrated mill. We have the farmer growing the fields, you know, just out the door. And then this the seed cleaning operation right there next door to us, the mill. We have this beautiful Italian stone mill. It's still very artisanal. It's not a giant grain elevator that you might have, you know, seen in most states have these big mills. It's much, much smaller. And then it goes out the door right there. So it gets turned into pancake mixes, all these different kinds of flour, flour for chefs and restaurants and bakeries, as well as flour for, you know, grocery stores. And then, of course, our online store, people, home bakers can just order directly from us. So, yeah, it's a really fun place to work. It's a fun place to be. We used to offer tours. We don't do that anymore since COVID. But we loved showing people like where their flour came from and connecting them directly with the source of their grains and flour.
Emma, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She joined us today to talk about why she enjoys using unique flours and grains in her recipes. You can find one of those recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. It is a chocolate-flecked farro or farro banana bread. Again, find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. Maybe make some over the weekend and you can drop it off at the studio for me on Monday. That would work out really well, actually. That would work for me. Also, if you have experiences cooking, baking, whatever, with a lot of the different grains we've been talking about or others off the beaten path, you can tell us all about it. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. Maybe you've got a recipe of your own you'd like to share.
Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, don't miss your state capitol report. Kate Archer Kent talks to outgoing state senator and Republican chair of the Senate Elections Committee, Kathy Bernier. That's Mondays from 7 to 9 here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up after 6 on 1A+, President Biden helped broker a deal to avert a railroad strike, a new Republican push on abortion falters, and just how bad was that report that put stocks in a spin this week? Join Jen White for the very latest tonight after 6 on the Ideas Network. Now, lawmakers announced that they are going to delay a vote in the U.S. Senate on the Respect for Marriage Act until after the November midterm elections. The bill, which has already passed the House, would write into law protections for same-sex and interracial marriages. The bill's lead sponsor, Wisconsin Democrat Tammy Baldwin, has been trying to secure enough Republican support to pass, but some opponents are worried about how the law could impact religious liberties. Here's Senator Baldwin in an interview this week on CNN.
That's one of the concerns that my Republican colleagues have been raising. A new law, does that create some new exemptions? And the answer is absolutely not. And while we think it is clear and said so in the op-ed, we are entertaining a clarifying amendment so that that argument falls flat and we can get the necessary number of Republicans to join all the Democrats and pass the Respect for Marriage Act.
But evidently not until after the midterm elections. So we're taking a closer look this afternoon at the bill and the religious liberty concerns that have come with it. And we want to hear from you as well at 1-800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this Respect for Marriage Act or the old Defense of Marriage Act, which is now on the books? Do you want to see the new law passed in, and do you agree with the concerns about how it could affect churches' religions? 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Howard Schwaber is a professor of political science and legal studies and affiliate faculty at the Law School of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And Howard, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So we hear a lot about the Respect for Marriage Act codifying same-sex and interracial marriages into law, but what does that mean legally, Howard?
Right. So it's a little bit complicated. The act is broken into parts. There are three sections that matter. Section 2 of the act repeals the old Defense of Marriage Act, which was overruled, which was ruled unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court in United States versus Windsor. That has to be pretty uncontroversial, unless and until the Supreme Court reverses that ruling. This is just bringing federal law in accordance with what the Supreme Court says the Constitution requires. So it's hard to see how anybody could really object to that. But the sections 3 and 4 are much more interesting. Section 3 refers to something called the Full Faith and Credit Clause. Now, the Full Faith and Credit Clause of the Constitution is a clause that says each state is required to recognize and give validity to the actions of other states. But there are limits on that principle. One of those limits historically and traditionally has been states are not required to recognize marriages performed in other states. So, for example, different states have different age requirements for marriage. If one state allows marriage at, let's say, 15, a different state that doesn't allow marriage until the age of 18 historically has not been required to recognize as valid a marriage between 15-year-olds. And the theory is that the Full Faith and Credit Law clause gives way in situations where recognition of another state's actions would interfere with the basic public policy of the receiving state. The reason for that long-winded explanation is that this law purports to do something really very interesting that hasn't gotten much attention as far as I can see. It purports to make it a matter of federal law that all states must recognize marriages from all other states. And to me, the interesting question there is not on that section is not so much about religious freedom as it is about why does Congress have the authority to do this at all?
So this would be a states' rights issue, and the law or the bill that is written, the Respect for Marriage Act, would supersede those states' rights when it came to recognizing marriages?
Well, it's partly a states' rights issue. It's actually more immediately a separation of powers issue because it is the courts and the Supreme Court that in the past have said states don't have to recognize marriages under the Full Faith and Credit Clause. So this looks a lot like Congress trying to tell the courts how to interpret the Constitution. And that's something that the courts and the Supreme Court in particular have been very, very eager to prevent in the past, going back to the 1980s and 90s.
Howard Schrader.
But there's also one other section of the law. Oh, sorry.
No, that's what I was asking about, this fourth section here.
Right. So section 4 says, and again, it's worded in an interesting way. It doesn't say that the federal government must recognize all interracial or all same-sex marriages. It says the federal government must recognize as valid marriages that are recognized as valid wherever they're performed. So if a state recognizes same-sex marriage, the federal government must recognize a same-sex marriage in that state as valid. If a state does not recognize same-sex marriage, the federal government has no obligation under this law to, for example, grant marital tax status to a couple claiming to be married in contravention of the law of the state that they're in. So you've got three pieces here. You've got two pieces that really matter. That Full Faith and Credit section says that any state official who refuses to accept as valid and give effect to a marriage from another state can be sued by the people who are affected. And Section 4, that federal law section, says that for all purposes, and there are an enormous, more than 1,000 places in the federal law where being married or not being married matters for one reason or another. In all of those areas, all of those parts of the federal law, the federal government must follow whatever the state of origin of the marriage is.
Howard Schwaber, our guest, professor of political science and legal studies, along with affiliate faculty at the UW-Madison Law School. And while the repealing of the Defense of Marriage Act would be considered uncontroversial to you, Howard, because it was ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, isn't that decision from the Supreme Court the reason that we're revisiting these marriage equality rights today?
Well, that depends whom you ask. So this discussion goes back to the Dobbs case that overruled Roe versus Wade in June. And there was a great deal of discussion both in the opinions in that case and in commentary about that case. Does this mean the Supreme Court is poised to overrule Obergefell versus Hodges, which was the case that gave constitutional protection to same-sex marriage, or to overrule Windsor versus the United States, which was the case that said the federal government must recognize same-sex marriages if a state recognizes them? The justices have not said they have any intention of overruling those cases. A lot of people, myself included, suspect it's a distinct possibility. So, you know, the way this question was framed was about religious freedom. And I find that a very, very interesting way to frame the issue, because nothing in this law obviously affects religious freedom in any way. Nothing in the Respect for Marriage Act says anything about the way private individuals have to conduct their businesses, churches have to conduct their services. It only affects the way state officials have to ask. And the reason that's so interesting is if you remember the case of Kim Davis, the county clerk in Kentucky, who, in defiance of the order of the governor, refused to issue a marriage license to a same-sex couple. In March of 2022, just this past March, a federal court ruled that she had violated their rights and couldn't do that. The only way I can really easily see any kind of religious freedom issue here is if the Republicans want to argue that state officials who have religious objections to their own state's laws shouldn't have to enforce them. But that would be a really radical position. So I really have to wonder whether the whole issue of religious liberty is just a smokescreen here, or whether perhaps people simply haven't read the law.
Howard Schwaber, our guest, and if you would like to join the conversation or if you have questions for our expert, please join us at 1-800-642-1234. But Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas wrote an opinion that the court may want to rethink the Obergefell decision from 2015 in the decision that ended Roe v. Wade or changed Roe v. Wade. So how big of a concern is there that the court could reconsider this decision in other similar cases, Howard?
Well, we have to break it down a little bit because Thomas's opinion said a lot more than that. There are basically, this can get complicated, but there are basically two kinds of constitutionally guaranteed rights that apply against the states. One is a set of rights that comes from the Bill of Rights, from the text of the Bill of Rights, and is applied against the states through a doctrine called incorporation. So the Bill of Rights only applied against the federal government up until the 1920s, but in the 20th century, it's been held to apply, or some of it, or most of it, has been held to apply to the states. The other set of rights are called substantive due process rights. And all of the rights that aren't actually in the Bill of Rights that we're familiar with, including the right to privacy, for example, fall into that category, or the right of parents to control the education of their children, a whole slew of rights. Thomas's opinion called on the court to revisit and perhaps reject all of those rights.
Oh.
Not necessarily because he's hostile to the rights themselves, but because he thinks that way back in the 1870s, there was a major error of reasoning, and we should go back and start over. Thomas's position on this is consistent. He's made this argument for many years, and no one else on the court has ever bought it. So there's little chance, I think, of this court or following the Roberts Court, following Thomas all the way down that particular rabbit hole, wiping out more than 100 years of rights jurisprudence and starting over from scratch. On the other hand, not only Thomas's opinion, but also Alito and other justices wrote things that seemed to suggest that there's a distinction between the cases that came before Roe, finding things like a right to privacy for contraception, for example, and cases that came after Roe, like Obergefell. Certainly politically, we know it's a cause very near and dear to the hearts of judicial conservatives to overturn same-sex marriage as a right. So, I mean, that's second after abortion. On the list of priorities. So on the one hand, it does not seem likely that the Roberts Court is going to wipe out, you know, rights that were recognized in the 1910s and 20s and, you know, 40s and 50s. On the other hand, it is hard to be confident that they will not revisit the same-sex marriage cases. And statements by Republican members of the Senate to the effect, for example, oh, well, this court would never revisit a decision that affects so many people's lives, you know, are kind of belied by the fact that in Dobbs they overruled Roe. And right now we have Lindsey Graham proposing a national anti-abortion law. So it's a very intensely political constitutional debate, and one in which I think people are quite right to at least be very concerned that the constitutional right to same-sex marriage recognition could very well be on the block in this next term or the one after.
1-800-642-1234 to join us with our guest, Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies, affiliate faculty at the law school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. What do you want to know about this legislation? What questions do you have about your rights and how they may be changing? Or others' rights? Are they yours too? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our conversation continues on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're continuing our conversation with Howard Schwaber, legal studies and political science professor at UW-Madison. He's with us today looking at the Respect for Marriage Act and why some opponents have concerns about its passage. You can join us at any point, 1-800-642-1234. And what questions do you have about religious liberties, marriage equality, civil rights? Do you think we have enough legal protections for religious freedoms in this country? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or ideas at WPR.org anytime. And Howard, this bill itself, and Senator Baldwin points this out, it's less than 500 words total. The bill is shorter than her op-ed piece that she published promoting it. Do you think the way it was written left too much up to interpretation? Does it need more clarification? Or, as you mentioned, should some of these clauses be eliminated to make it more palatable?
Well, I think there's a real conflict here between the political optics and the actual content of the bill. In this instance, and frankly, quite often, short is good. Very often, it's the wordy bills and the long-winded explanations that raise ambiguities and complexities. This is very straightforward and very simple as a set of legal principles. And as I said, I think the most potentially controversial legal issue is one no one seems to be paying attention to, which is, can Congress dictate how the Constitution is interpreted by courts as a matter of separation of powers? But the political optics are all about the religious freedom issue. And again, I truly don't see how that's involved, since this law does not purport to regulate any private citizen's behavior. But certainly, and Senator Baldwin has said this, you know, it wouldn't hurt anything to add an amendment that says nothing in this law shall be construed to in any way change existing protections for religious freedom. And if that would satisfy some members, Republican members of the Senate, you know, I certainly don't see any harm in adding it.
And we've mentioned Senator Baldwin here, but what about Wisconsin's other U.S. Senator, Ron Johnson? Do we know where he stands on this issue and this bill, the Respect for Marriage Act?
We really don't, not because he hasn't said anything, but because he has said things that seem to contradict one another in a relatively short period. I think my read is that Senator Johnson is still trying to figure out what his position should be as a political matter, and so to speak, which way the winds are blowing. And he will ultimately decide whether to support or oppose the bill solely based on that calculation. I don't think any change to the content. I don't think he has any genuine concerns about the content. I think he's just trying to figure out what's the best way to position himself on an issue that is, after all, divisive among Republican Wisconsin voters, as well as, of course, Democratic Wisconsin voters.
Sure. And Howard Schwaber, as we look at the politics of this, now we know that the vote will be pushed past the midterms. Does that give perhaps the inclination that this bill will be passed, will get 10 Republican votes at some point, but not before we vote on them first?
It does. So it's an interesting maneuver. And again, this is only my opinion, obviously, but it seems to me that this decision increases the chance of the bill being passed, but decreases the significance of the debate for the midterms themselves. So a lot of Democrats would love to have this bill be one of the things that is front and center going into the midterms, because all sorts of polling data show that majorities of Americans, even majorities of Republicans, majorities of you know, pretty much any category you can name, Protestants, Catholics, however you want to slice up the electorate, support same-sex marriage rights. So on the one hand, from the Democrats' perspective, you know, it might be useful to have this in everyone's face going into the midterms and say, see, if you vote for Republicans, you're voting against your own belief in the right to same-sex marriage. Conversely, if this is an issue in the midterms, that makes it much harder for Republican senators, remember this has been passed in the House, so we're talking about the Senate, to take a position that might alienate their base. And of course, when you start talking about parties and bases and districts or states, excuse me, that are significantly blue or significantly red, you know, someone running for Senate has a lot less freedom of maneuver. So I think this is, on the one hand, a really good decision if the goal is to secure marriage equality in federal law. As a purely tactical partisan move, it weakens the Democratic position. But that's presumably one of the reasons Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, was willing to co-sponsor the bill, that it has been, by this move, I won't say removed from consideration in the midterms, but a much, much less central issue.
Yeah. Who do you think, Howard Schwaber, benefits the most and who would benefit the least from this bill? And who stands to gain here?
Well, So the background, I mean, the point of all this is something I said earlier, which is that a lot of people think it is possible the Supreme Court will change its mind and remove the constitutional protection from same-sex marriage. And so in the first instance, this bill uses federal law to protect same-sex couples who want to get married and everything that goes with that, their children, right? All of the things that go along with that legal status. And so in that sense, you know, the benefit is very clear. It's protecting a vulnerable minority. Politically, I think it's much less clear. First of all, if this bill is passed, I think that will primarily have the effect of removing same-sex marriage as a partisan political issue, except in local elections, or in primaries. In other words, once you get a lot of primaries take place in very safe districts. As a result, they are won by candidates who take ideologically fairly extreme positions, trying to appeal to the base, as we say. But as a matter of national politics or state legislative politics, you know, the issue will be largely off the table. The problem is, as I say, I think that there's a serious constitutional defect in this bill. I think that if this came before the Supreme Court, if it were passed as a law, it might very well be struck down on separation of powers grounds, having nothing to do with the underlying issue. And that would throw everything into chaos. So I will be watching very, very curiously to see what is said about the full faith and credit clause element of the bill and whether that piece reaches a federal court sooner rather than later.
And again, Howard, you earlier said that this was because the Respect for Marriage bill appears to be telling the courts from Congress how to interpret the Constitution. And so would there be some unintended consequences that you could see as a result of this bill passing as it is?
Only that the court might reject it. So the Supreme Court, going back to the 1980s, has taken a very, very strong line that Congress does not get to tell courts how to interpret the Constitution. The court has been very jealous of that authority. So, you know, unintended. I mean, you can see why the provision is there. A federal law to be effective in this area, right, has to, all federal laws, if they're valid, supersede state laws. This one would have to declare that state laws are what is called preempted. So the federal law trumps, and states are required to recognize same-sex marriages and interracial marriages. Well, that one, of course, is not really an immediate issue, even for people who travel across state lines. That's certainly a good intention and unquestionably an element that is essential to make this law effective. The unintended consequence may be that Congress is simply overreaching. It is not clear, at least to me, what is the basis for federal authority to decide this question. And so all kinds of questions about separation of powers and federalism and the powers of Congress that people really aren't thinking about right now, because right now, of course, we're all thinking about the rights question and the equality question and the marriage question. But all those other structural issues really are very much at the heart of this thing. And I don't think that the authors of the bill have taken sufficient care. For example, there's nothing in the bill that explains the justification for the assertion of federal authority here, which is something you see quite a lot in federal economic legislation, for example.
So maybe 500 words in this bill could be expanded a little more to protect the bill a little more against court challenges in the future?
It might be a worthwhile endeavor. I'm not sure it can be effective.
And finally, Howard, and we only have about a minute left here, but the argument we've heard against the Respect for Marriage Act has largely circled around religious liberties, which is something you haven't seen here. You've provided a more nuanced and certainly constitutional perspective on potential issues with this bill. But what about religious liberties here? Are they being infringed upon?
Since the law, the proposed federal law, doesn't dictate anything to any private party, it's hard for me to see how. No one who is not a state official is called upon to do anything under this law. So the only way there could be a religious liberty issue is if you say that someone who is a state official who has religious objections to something therefore doesn't have to carry out state law. That's the Kim Davis position. I should say that Kim Davis's lawyers have said they want to use her case to try and secure an overruling of Obergefell and Windsor, those cases I mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So they understand perfectly well that they're swimming upstream, but they're hoping for a change in constitutional doctrine. But I have to say, it is very difficult for me to see how religious liberty is an issue here at all. I rather suspect that a lot of people raising that point haven't looked at the bill carefully.
Howard, yeah, and I apologize because we are plumb out of time here this afternoon, but always appreciate your perspective. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Howard Schwaber, professor of political science and legal studies at the UW-Madison, also an affiliate faculty at the law school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.